Hey, everybody, this is Dr. Josh Yellen taking over the sports medicine broadcast for Jeremy Jackson at the Sports Medicine Update here in Houston. We're sitting here with Marnie Collins. Marnie is an attorney. Tell me where you practice, Marnie.
Well, I currently am an in-house counsel for a large school district in Texas, Cypress Fairbanks ISD, third largest school district in Texas. I was in private practice for 8 years before coming in-house.
And so let's just kind of go back in time a little bit. Where did you go to law school?
I went to the University of Houston.
Go Cougs.
That's right.
I am the program director of the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston.
Awesome.
Go Cougs. Go Cougs. All right. So, and then from that point on, you graduated and you went into private practice, right?
I did.
And what was your area of specialty?
I went to work for what was then Bracewell and Giuliani and did public entity law. So I represented school districts, public school districts, some private cities, counties, but primarily in some junior colleges, but primarily public school districts.
So your area of specialty is really in education?
It is in education, public law.
Okay, great. So just to kind of set the table here, my bachelor's is in athletic training, my master's in sports medicine, but my doctorate is in educational leadership. And so we learned all about, you know, the legal. You're very familiar with it.
Yes, I actually have co-taught some of the graduate education law graduate classes.
Great. As a matter of fact, my mentor is Dr. Ken Lane. He was at Southeastern Louisiana University. He is the president of the Educational Law Society. So he was my dissertation chair, so I really focused on legal and ethical and regulatory concerns, and I apply that to athletic training. And so let's kind of move into the conversation. So right now, and the last time that I was on the show with Jeremy Jackson, we had Josh Woodall on, and Josh is the president of SWATA, the Southwest Athletic Trainers Association. He is also a high school-based athletic trainer in Bryan ISD. And so we talk about how athletic trainers, the high school-based athletic trainers, there's a lot of talk right now about secondary school settings. And obviously there are some student athletic trainer programs, what we call student aides. You know, the NATA says that there are student aides, and they put out position statements about all that. And they talk about what the student aide should be used for, so on and so forth. So we're going to set that part aside. And let's go back in time a little bit. If you're a high school-based athletic trainer anywhere in the country, you have to be familiar with both FERPA and HIPAA.
Correct.
So for those that are not familiar with FERPA, because, right, healthcare provider, I may not be familiar with FERPA unless I'm in secondary school setting or at the university. Explain what FERPA is, explain how it came about, explain how it merges or how it's similar to HIPAA.
Well, FERPA stands for, which is funny, educators, we like our acronyms, and FERPA almost sounds like a bad word, but it's the Family Education Rights Privacy Act, but we all just call it FERPA. And I want to say it came about as some of the, shortly after some of the civil rights litigation, I believe it's 1974 approximately, but it's a federal law. And I explain it when I'm explaining it to school personnel as well as parents. It's both a sword and a shield. It's a sword in that it gives parents an absolute right of access to the records of their children, and then as an adult student, the absolute right of access to your own records. But it's also a shield in that it limits the third parties who will have access to those records except certain enumerated exceptions. The most common one that we deal with is if you are a school official with a legitimate educational interest in the record, then you may have access to the record without parent permission. But generally speaking, if the exceptions do not apply, you have to have parent permission in order to access records. So that's how it is similar to HIPAA. HIPAA, of course, is a federal law that was passed in order to bring, as I understand it, uniformity to how medical records were shared, particularly those who were shared electronically. But for those who provide healthcare services in the educational setting, I think it's a little bit easier for you all because there is a specific provision within HIPAA that says if FERPA applies, then HIPAA does not.
Yeah, right.
So as an athletic trainer, if I have a treatment record on a student athlete, I have anything that I am maintaining as part of my job as a school employee who happens to be an athletic trainer, then FERPA actually applies. And it's a little different because sometimes that accessibility may be a little bit different than you might have in private practice. And what I mean by that is parents, I'm going to get this sometimes with my psychologists, in-house psychologists, when they're unsure what they can disclose to a parent out of their files, and I try to explain to them, pretty much everything in your file a parent is going to have access to. So it's always good for employees to remember that.
As long as, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert in this area, as long as the student has given permission in a college setting, as long as the student has given permission to the parent.
I'm sorry, you know what? Thank you for that clarification. I forget that we're not just dealing with K through 12.
Right.
Yes, college, you are correct. Once, and that's why I alluded to it earlier and I should have been more clear. When I say a parent, I always should say also or an adult student.
Okay.
Because once that student turns 18, those rights move to
It's very similar to HIPAA, right? So
yes.
I have a child, right? My kids are 15 and going to be 12. By the way, my wife is getting her second master's degree as a licensed school. In Texas, it's not a school psychologist. It's a
LSSP.
Licensed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So she's finished her second master's degree. Just a side note, between the two of us, we'll have three master's degrees and a doctorate, and we're going to be the poorest, smartest people you'd ever met. Okay. So back to the HIPAA and the FERPA. So FERPA in the secondary, right, K through 12, the parent always has a right to see those files. Is there anything that the administrator needs to do or needs to know to release those files to the parent?
Well, and again, K through 12, and even in your, once you get to 12, you may have an adult student. So mm-hmm. when I say parent slash adult student, there may be an extenuating circumstance where you might be allowed to withhold that record in a health and safety situation. But generally speaking, yes, they're going to have an adult student or parent's going to have a right of access. One thing to keep in mind, typically as a best practice, I do advise that you get that request for disclosure in writing,
mm-hmm.
And that you maintain that in accordance with your record retention. And but generally speaking, yes, it's going to be an absolute right of access.
And then so let's go back to something you said before about a legitimate right to know. So you have an athletic trainer in the secondary school setting. So let's just stay in the K through 12 realm right now. You have an athletic trainer in the secondary school setting, and that athletic trainer is treating a student athlete, football player, basketball player, whatever it is. And that athletic trainer has a legitimate right to know about what's happening because they're medical records. Let's say a coach intervenes and says, I want to know what's happening with, you know, child ABC, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Does that coach have a legitimate right to know? Or is it one of those things of I can only tell you so much information?
Well, that's a good question as well. And whether it is a coach to an athletic trainer or a classroom teacher to an athletic trainer who just has a special interest in Johnny. Hey, I saw Johnny on the sidelines mm-hmm. Saturday on your table. Is he okay? I mean, a legitimate question.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to apply the filter that says you have to really two parts to in order to have access to the educational information under FERPA. You need to be a school official.
Okay.
But the second part is with a legitimate educational interest in the information.
Right. So let's define what is it in the state's eyes, what is a school official?
Well, and under FERPA, the federal law, it doesn't define it other than a school official would be someone by local policy. You would look to see if you have how you have defined that. And
mm-hmm.
so typically in our code of conduct and handbook in our school district and most across the state, they will give notice to parents.
Mm-hmm.
Here's who we consider to be school officials. FERPA doesn't define it, but does require that you define it.
Okay.
And so you would look to your local handbook, your local policy, wherever you give notice to parents. So a parent could know that a school official can also include a contractor. So say you are not a full-time athletic trainer,
mm-hmm.
you contract through a local hospital, you would still be considered a school official if you have correctly defined it in your notice to parents.
So it's autonomous to each district, or is it autonomous to each school?
Well, it is typically autonomous to each district. It could be autonomous to each school if you defined it as such within your policy.
And is it consistent for both public and private schools?
Well, FERPA does not apply to private schools, and so, but I would imagine that I have not represented an extensive amount of private schools, but those that I have been larger schools, and they have modeled their policies and practices after those. And so I would imagine for accreditation purposes, they are probably required to have the same level of confidentiality and the same type of disclosure.
Okay. So let's move on and let's talk about you're going to give a presentation here in a little bit. Let's talk about documentation. And
yes.
I always have a statement whenever I teach the administration class in our Master of Athletic Training program. And one of the first lessons I teach them is CYA equals CYA, right? So cover your fill in the blank equals see ya, go get somebody else. Because I have a chain of documentation. I have documented everything from recommendations to how the patient responded to treatment to those who I communicated with to my recommendations to, you know, all those different things. And so we're documenting. And so under FERPA, we have to document injury records, right?
Well, that's probably a best practice.
Okay.
FERPA doesn't require that you create records, but once you do, you have to maintain it and you may have to disclose it.
And so let's talk about that and let's put, you know, the elephant in the room when it comes to injury. The hot topic these days is concussion. And so you have a lot of medical professionals now that specialize in concussions and are talking about return to play, but there's also some return to learn guidelines. In these type of situations, tell me a little bit about the responsibility of the treating athletic trainer, the treating physician, and let's complicate things a little bit more. The treating athletic trainer is employed by the school. The treating physician is not, but could be a contractor. And who are they going to communicate with to set up proper intervention for that student? And then I want to kind of work into the IEP realm.
Well, ideally, they would work directly with the parent, and the line of communication between the parent and the school staff would be open and and flowing. And if necessary, permission would be granted by the parent for communication to occur directly between the athletic trainer and the doctor. But ideally, particularly with the doctor, the physician, that communication is going to be between the parent and the physician. Then they're going to be clear in their either restrictions or recommendations, put that in writing, then can be provided either directly to the athletic trainer or the parent provides what the physician has provided.
So there are a lot of moving parts in this, right? And so let's kind of back up and make sure that I'm following you. One is, the athletic trainer sees that athlete, right, and diagnoses them with a concussion and refers out to the treating physician who confirms the diagnosis.
Yes.
Okay. It's a minor, so we'll call the minor Johnny, right? And so the minor is Johnny, and now the athletic trainer and the physician are communicating directly with the parent and are telling the parent, look, Johnny's been diagnosed with a concussion. These are the guidelines and parameters that we want to put in place, and we're going to start our concussion protocol. Okay. Now, whose responsibility is it now to communicate with the teachers? Because Johnny has been diagnosed with a concussion and is more than likely going to be sensitive to light and is going to have trouble in the classroom and, you know, may miss an exam and may have trouble studying, may have trouble concentrating. So at that point, assuming that the parents have not given permission for the athletic trainer or the physician to speak to the teachers, it falls on the parents' responsibility, correct?
It does. I would say, however, if you've got your athletic trainer who is employed by the school district, and so he or she would be getting the information from the parent, I would say ideally both the athletic trainer and the parent would be communicating with staff. The trainer can disclose information to the parents without, excuse me, to the teachers without parent permission if they are, our two-part inquiry, a school official with a legitimate educational interest. So opposed to the teacher just wanting to know how Johnny was doing because he's one of my favorite students and I happen to follow of football versus I teach Johnny English and right now we're reading Beowulf. Mm-hmm. And, you know, besides the fact that reading Beowulf in and of itself without a concussion is hard mm-hmm. to do, mm-hmm. but, you know, so Johnny may not be able to sit and attend to task like that. And so it would be appropriate then for the athletic trainers to say, here are the restrictions we perceive teachers.
Right. And that's what I want our listeners to understand is that, you know, listen to the expert, listen to Marnie and how she's explaining the different parameters of what the athletic trainers can and cannot do. And the two things that you outline, I think the conversation, you know, the two themes that they need to understand from this conversation are, one, school official, the athletic trainer is a school official, mm-hmm. and two, they have a legitimate right to know, and that their communication to, you know, the art teacher, because maybe they tore their ACL, that art teacher doesn't have a legitimate right to know, and they're not a school official. However, if it is an English teacher, and they are studying, and the English teacher is concerned about Johnny's progress in class because the amount of mental work that's going to be put into it, well, at that point, that is a legitimate right to know.
Yes, absolutely. It's a legitimate reason as opposed to just wanting to know out of curiosity.
Okay. So now let's move in and complicate some matters some more, shall
okay.
we? Great. I love it. All right. So Johnny's been diagnosed with a concussion, and this happened on a Friday night, and they have an exam on Monday, and we know treatment protocols for concussions different than when I played, you know, decades ago, that there are different protocols in there to try to protect the brain, and what we realize is that we need to just shut the brain down and have some rest. So Johnny tries to return back to class and is having trouble. Mm-hmm. Speak to us from a legal aspect. There is now some return to learn protocols and return to play, sure, but return to learn. At what point do you recommend that, you know what, we may need a IEP in place. We may need a 504 in place.
Right, 504 would more likely be the scenario that you would find if the student hadn't otherwise qualified for specialized instruction. And so really what I've come to learn in my position just from dealing with different students is that concussions affect everyone differently, and mm-hmm. we may have a student that does not struggle with some of the attention to task and things where another student with a similar or maybe even what appears to be less severe concussion does, and they develop persistent symptoms and they just struggle with returning to the classroom. And so I've seen that a couple of times over the years. And so what we have done, once we recognize, and that's really the recognition is a collaborative effort between, you know, the athletic trainer saying, this is what I'm seeing, and the classroom teachers, mm-hmm. you know, sharing that. Oftentimes, counselors are a good center mm-hmm. for information because the teachers will often communicate with the counselors. And then sometimes the athletic trainers will communicate with the counselors as far as accommodations. And so what you would then need to do is work with the physician, determine if the student has a concussive syndrome, something well beyond a typical concussion. And if so, then they may qualify. They may have a student with a disability who, with or without reasonable accommodation, will need something in order to access the educational program. So you would put together a 504 plan, mm-hmm. committee first, determine mm-hmm. if the mm-hmm. student does need modifications or accommodations, and then the key people in place, and that could include your athletic trainer on your 504 committee to talk about some of the health aspects of it.
Well, we're getting the signal that I think that you're ready to rock and roll. What I'd like to do, if that's okay, is continue this conversation. I know that you don't have any time after today because you got to get to a meeting, but maybe we can go back to Pasadena High School with Jeremy Jackson, continue with this conversation, because
sure.
I have a whole nother list of questions for you about duty, breach of duty, negligence, tort law, all those yeah. other things.
Yeah, so you've got some immunities as public athletic trainers, not right. just under the Good Samaritan or, you know, I think it's the Good Samaritan law, mm-hmm. I don't remember the shorthand version, but you also, if you are a school volunteer, so if you are working for a hospital but yet you volunteer, then mm-hmm. you're going to have some immunities even though you're not an employee. Of course, as an employee, you have some of the strongest immunities under state and federal law, but there right. are other things that protect you as first responders.
So let's plan to continue this conversation at another time, disclosing information. If somebody wanted to contact you, and ask you some questions. How would they do that?
Well, I am actually in-house, and so I don't have a private practice, so I'm just at the school district. I would be happy to, to bounce ideas off of someone or collaborate. I work directly or closely with Robert Maniscalco. He's looking around like, don't say my name. But I work directly with some of the trainers at Memorial Hermann. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm Marnie Collins Sims, and I'm the general counsel at Cypress Fairbanks ISD. But there are many education lawyers, and I think we all probably could be better served by learning more about the athletic training community and working together to better serve the kids.
Great. I think
Thank
you're
you.
Ready to go.
Okay.
Thanks.
Nice to meet
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Marnie. Nice to meet you, too.